Hello, and welcome to the Plugged In podcast, the show where we talk to the people who make things tick in the media industry. Today, I'm joined by my friend Michael Slavin to talk to the Hashtag United Operations Director, Neil Smythe. If you've clicked on this podcast, you probably know who Hashtag United are, but if not, that's fine. Hashtag were founded 4 years ago by YouTuber Spencer Owen and have gone from strength to strength until now they find themselves in dreamland. And as we talk to Neil, this side are in the middle of an FA Cup roller coaster. The next game's on Saturday and we can't wait to tune in. Throughout our chat with Neil, we talk about Hashtag and his role there, but also about his previous experience in football media. He worked at Soccer AM and Copper 90, whilst also jetting around the world, meeting footballers as a producer. We also touch on the negative space online and the impact of drama in the YouTube world. For finally, Neil shares some invaluable advice about how to get into not just the football industry, but wider related media industries as well, so make sure you stick around for that. Make sure you're following Plugged In on Twitter and Instagram, but for now, enjoy a conversation with Neil Smythe. Neil, how are you feeling after that victory, and just how far can Hashtag go in the FA Cup?
Hello, guys. Two pretty big questions there. How am I feeling? Well, we are, 36 hours or so after the game, and yes, I've recovered just. But the thing about our season is that it just doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. It's already quite a compressed season, and the more successful you are, the more games you've got to fit in. I think the guys had done something like seven games in 16, 17 days. So actually, it feels like we've got a little bit of headspace now, given that we had the game on Monday. It's now Wednesday, and our next reserve game is Friday. So if I say I've got a headspace and we've got a game in 2 days, you'll know how frantic it is right now. In terms of how far can we go? Well, as I speak, the video of the FA Cup game isn't out, but Dev says pre-match, lads, you're not going to win the FA Cup. Now that came as no surprise to any of them. We are not going to win the FA Cup. You can have that as an exclusive. But to be honest with you, we are there for the journey. We are there for the journey. I've been so surprised by the interest and the hype and the buzz around the FA Cup. And it's partly to do with how we won these games, but also partly because that cup magic is still there. Don't let fans of Premier League clubs say that the magic isn't there, because it is at this level. So look, we're not going to win it, but you know, if you'd have said to me we'd win three games, two against higher league opposition, then I certainly would have settled for that. Spencer would give you a different answer. And in fact, when we did a preview before the first game, I made him put a prediction on a card, which I haven't seen.
Yes, I haven't seen
that. And I won't see that until we're knocked out. My feeling is Spen will have expected us to go probably one step further. But let's see if I'm proven right or wrong. But in terms of this season, our priorities, and I sound like a Premier League manager here, but it's true, our priorities as a football club are for the league and probably for the VARs. You know, the fans don't quite understand it yet, but the VARs is probably more important to us in the sense that, theoretically, there's a much better chance of us winning it. It's a massive competition and it's not going to be easy. And we got knocked out very quickly last year. But theoretically, we should be one of the better sides in there because it stops at our level. So the VARs is more important. And in terms of longevity for the club, the league is the number one priority. So, yeah, I'm just loving the ride right now.
I bet. I listened to an interview with you when you just before you kind of started your first season with Hashtag, as Hashtag entered the, I believe it was the 9th or 10th stage of the football pyramid. And you said about, no, we do want to build a community. You know, we've come from online first, but we want to build a community. And this week on Twitter, myself and Michael, we have seen our phones blowing up with just everyone's talking about Hashtag United. So there's most in an absolutely overwhelming good way, but then some, you know, people who don't really understand the movement. How have you found the kind of communal element just absolutely exploding over the last few weeks?
Well, specifically over the last few weeks, yeah, even I, who've been around in the industry 20 odd years, I've been surprised by it. I think we're good at trying to build our audience. I think we're very good at engaging our online community, but I've been absolutely stunned by this new surge in interest? I mean, somebody shared a tweet from a non-league sort of stats account today saying we'd put on 20,000 Twitter followers in a couple of weeks. Now, Twitter's so hard to grow on nowadays. 20,000, ridiculous. In lockdown, we were probably losing followers. So that's immense. And the renewed interest on YouTube is incredible as well. I think that's partly down to Spencer persuading some of his creator mates to come along. And that's been amazing for us. But also, as a kind of modern, independent online entity, perhaps sometimes we underplay the value of someone like the BBC. The value of the BBC covering us the other day, again, has really stunned me. And the interest amongst people who didn't know about us has been amazing. In terms of the criticism of us as an entity, as a club that we've had, particularly over the last couple of weeks, I'm used to it and we're used to it by now. We had a lot of negative feedback, especially in probably the non-league football community, when we started this phase of our journey 2.5 years ago. I think we won a lot of people over, or have done over the last couple of years. And I think as we grow our audience, when we have kind of seismic shifts in our audience like we're seeing at the moment, that will always come with an element of negativity. And as I say, we accept it. And I think our hope is, in the long run, we can win most people over. We're never going to win everybody over, but we do our best to do things right in every kind of facet of what we do. And I'm hoping we'll convert a lot of people. One of the things that frustrates me when we have negativity is the negativity around the name.
Oh, yeah.
And even people who like us say, oh, you know, lads, change your name. Well, now, Spencer does this in a far more erudite way or passionate way than I can. And he did a video on, he did Jack Mate's podcast the other week. And if you see that, he tells the story of why and how the name came about. And it's hard to disagree with that origin, really. And also, what I have to remind people on football Twitter is, you know, not every football club has a proper place name as its name. Port Vale, for example.
Arsenal.
The next thing I was going to say is a lot of football clubs, traditional, in inverted commas, football clubs, got their names from a group of mates who got together, you know, back in the day, you know, whether it was railways or ironworks or what have you. And so team names were essentially developed around the idea of a group of workmates. Now, if you work essentially online and your community is online, what better name than something that represents that? So I understand, you know, I worked around in football content for long enough to understand that some football fans are traditional, but we don't need to change our name. And if you don't like it and we don't win you over, then so be it. We're probably not for you, you know?
Hashtag United has obviously been very interesting in sort of the recent years in a footballing perspective, in the success you've had in the league and now in the FA Cup. I was wondering, from this is a predominantly media podcast, there have been a lot of YouTube football teams. So there's been Rebel, there's SE Dons, there's various other teams that have tried to crop up. In terms of sort of your strategy from when it was just sort of playing against the Arsenal, like, staff or something like that, or when you were doing these smaller matches, what about the media strategy you think allowed you to grow and grow and grow and now become a fully fledged team that is sort of working their way up the football ladder?
So it's important to stress that I wasn't there in the early days. I came in to run the media for this new chapter, if you like, when we moved from exhibition into non-league football. But what I can say about those early days is I think Spen was one of the first movers in that space. I think Palmers were there as a Sunday League team, and we have massive amounts of respect for what they've done. I think the early success was down to the fact it was something new. And in fact, Spencer FC's first game as a team was against my old team at TFR. So I was kind of talking to Spen and Seb in those early days about shall we set up a league of YouTube teams? And I think the thought process was, you know, independent, non-rights-based content that I'd been working in for several years, from Copper 90 to Full Time Devils and what have you, had really started to grow massively, because I think the younger digital savvy audience were a little bit perhaps bored or underserved in terms of relevant football content. You know, Match of the Day, certainly back 10 years ago, was dominated by much older ex-pros. Football interviews, despite what SoccerM tried to do, football interview content was largely spun a little bit too carefully and footballers were cosseted. So I think as the result, football fans who are becoming more digitally aware and more used to debating and arguing and having their say with their own voice on social media, they weren't going to take this anymore. So a new wave of football content grew up where there were no rules. And I'm looking at FIFA content in the early days as well. There were no rules. And so understandably, as a young football fan watching content on YouTube, you gravitate towards this content that has a more relevant, authentic, perhaps edgy tone. I think that's the environment that allowed all of these football channels to thrive, whether they played football matches or FIFA, or whether they were Copper 90 doing docs, or, you know, Arsenal Fan TV. I think in terms of hashtag, I think the genius of those early days was in Spen's structure, or I think he gives credit to Seb, the structure of that league system, which to outsiders seemed bizarre, the fact that it was one team in this league competing against themselves, essentially. But that gave the story a proper narrative and a proper journey. And I think that's what stood them out in the early days, as well as obviously Spencer's talent as a creator and an ideas man and as a host. But that's what differentiated them, because fans like to follow a narrative and like to follow a journey. And there's only so much interest, I think, in random games played against other random teams. And I think it's no surprise that since then, teams on YouTube have focused more on, you know, jumping into leagues, and whether it's at, you know, official non-league level or Sunday league level, so that they can tell the story of that journey rather than individual games. So I think that was the genius of the early days. I think in general, and this goes for probably most of the people in the scene, and I think what they all share is this, again, relevant, authentic tone. Some people have different production values, some people have different tones, but look at them all. I think they're all relevant and authentic. And I think these teams are doing a better job in many cases than some of the pro teams out there.
I think that authenticity that you mentioned is so important, because I personally grew up in that landscape. I grew up watching these, you know, FIFA YouTubers. I grew up watching these football reaction channels. And as a Man United fan, can't tell by my accent, but I...
Yes, I can.
Brilliant. Well, I think these football channels do get you closer, because there's only so many kind of interviews you can watch with, like, Lee Grant in lockdown, you know. But these channels, they're much more authentic. And was that kind of one of the reasons that you moved into Fremantle Media, who more traditionally associated with, like, the X Factor, Britain's Got Talent? You moved into there and made, like, Full Time Devils, Football Republic, more sort of football channels. Was that because you saw that gap in the market and you thought you could really expand on that?
Yeah, well, before I go specifically on that, just jumping on one of your points there, and to give credit to the you know, the pro clubs where it's due and the pro players, I think what we saw in lockdown was when more established sports rights holders, let's widen it out to sport rather than just football, when they lost their live highlights, which is generally everybody's kind of top tier content, what most rights holders and rights owners focus on, everyone was scratching around for new content to create without the games. And that's when I think the penny dropped with a lot of people in the industry. And that's that modern, and I say predominantly younger, digitally savvy sports fans want authentic content. And if that means one of your players messing about in his kitchen on Zoom, then so be it. So I think we're going to see a real shift now, even if there wasn't one before, in more established names in sport doing more authentic, almost amateur UGC style content, if you like. But to go back to your question, I think if I look at my career arc as a whole, and I've been in sports content over 20 years now, there is one through line, and that's that I gravitate to content which puts fans first. And, you know, that's from Soccer AM to Copper 90 to Fremantle to Formula E to an extent and to here. That's what I like doing. I like trying to engage fans on a different, sometimes alternative, sometimes edgy way. I think, and I can't talk for it now because I left, 13 years ago, but I think what Soccer AM was, and probably still is, when it really works, is an alternative viewpoint of football. And I think the context for somebody of my age, and I'm 50 next month, is, I still can't believe I'm saying that, by the way, is that when I was 10 and I watched West Ham beat Arsenal, I believe, in the FA Cup, the only way I could see that was live on TV. I couldn't obviously record it. I couldn't watch it again. If I wanted to relive that game, you could buy an LP. I'm talking like a record, right? You know what physical records are. This shows how old I am. But you could buy an LP via mail order that had the commentary. And that was really the only way of reliving football in those days.
Really?
And all you had on TV, yes, really. All you had on TV really was Match of the Day. And bear in mind, there was like one or two live games a year and everything else was. So that was the context. And then on ITV, Saint and Greavesy came along. I know this is a really long answer to your question, but it's kind of it's a history of football content. And this is where I come from. Saint and Greavesy was, I guess, mid to late 80s, probably late 80s. And they were two aging footballers, but they brought comedy, a really sort of slightly off the wall angle to football. And that was the first, I think, of that kind, followed by fantasy football with Bedil and Skinner, and then Soccer AM. And then it's kind of snowballed from there. So I think, I'm attracted to content which doesn't necessarily put the rights first, but puts fans first. And that's what I've tried to do ever since. And, you know, specifically on Fremantle, what happened there was relevant, which was, yes, they're the same production company that does the Shiny Floor shows, but they have a digital arm. And at the time, and probably still now to an extent, there's a remit to experiment. Yes, obviously, you're looking after the digital rights of Britain's Got Talent or X Factor or what have you. But there was a remit to experiment. And the boss of the department was same age as me, so he's about 40 at the time, and a Manchester United fan. And he said that there was nothing really to serve him as a fan. Yeah, again, he had the games. Yes, he had the official MUTV stuff, but it was bland, it was dry, and it wasn't independent. So he saw that gap in the market. Yes, I think the Red Men had just started. So Liverpool had their channel. And so the genesis of the Fremantle Network was, let's create something for Man United fans by United fans. Now, ironically, I'm not a Manchester United fan, but he knew that I had the relevance in the space And that's how that started. And then obviously everyone I hired subsequently had to be a Manchester United fan. That was the kind of ethos of the whole channel. But yeah, that's why I got involved, because I just wanted to give something back to United fans when they didn't have it, really.
With that, I was wondering, there's been a lot of criticism in the past of a lot of people feel unfair criticism of fan channels because of, especially around the era, the latter years of Arsene Wenger at Arsenal, and Arsenal Fan TV got a lot of criticism for that and for their coverage. Do you believe that even in 2020 there is still a place for these fan channels, and what do you make of that whole controversy that happened around Arsenal Fan TV?
Yeah, so I actually get asked about this more than anything else. And
oh, really?
No, it's fine. It's fine. And it's really, no, it's fine. I find it really interesting.
Yeah, me too. And
I think I was always of this opinion even when I created it. So I created Full Time Devils, as I say, to give a voice to Manchester United fans, whether that was from, whether we're from Salford or Singapore or Sheffield or what have you. Football fans, there's always an element of, you have to support your local team and you have to go to every reserve game, otherwise you're not a real fan, right? I don't believe in that. So I wanted to try and connect United fans globally. I also wanted to give them a range of content, and this is really important to this question. And I think we always did while I was at Devils and on all the channels we did. There were previews, there were reviews, there were squad updates, there was silly sketches. You know, it was supposed to be a rounded schedule. We didn't actually do fan cams for the first few months. And I think in the first season we started, United won the league. And some of my favourite Full-Time Devils videos are the videos we've made from fans around the world celebrating that last, as it turned out to be so far, league win. So that's really important again in the context. We did really well with positive content. Yes, then the following season, in terms of United, Moyes came in. Was it Moyes? Yeah,
it was.
Moyes came in and didn't do well. Didn't do well. And then for us, the Andy Tate thing happened, which I learned an amazing, incredible amount from on different levels. Basically, nutshell, check it out, biggest fool in Manchester.
He's the biggest fool in Manchester, and that is you, David Moyes.
This video absolutely banged, and it didn't bang initially through anything we did. We just gave this guy a platform. And he was probably that first rant that really took over. It then absolutely snowballed. And then I think other channels saw, and we obviously noticed, because I pay attention to analytics, we noticed that there is value in rants. All I can say is, from my point of view, I have a fairly experienced editorial head on me now. And I like to think I'm ethical. And I like to think I kind of put fans and the ethics of the business first. And I can tell you there are many videos after that that I didn't publish, even though I knew they would bang, because I could either see that they were manufactured in terms of the person on camera almost scripting it or not meaning what he was saying because he wanted a hit, or that the person I was putting on camera was going to be put at risk by what he was saying. So from my point of view, and I didn't film or edit all most of these clips at Devils, but I was overseeing them, and I remember telling my producers, you know, this clip, that clip, mustn't go up. So I had a firm hand on that. Now, I didn't run all of the fan channels out there. You know, I ran, I think, 7 in total. But certainly one of the ones you mentioned was never under my jurisdiction, although I talked to Arsenal Fan TV about merging in a network. And before I say this, I have to say I have, again, massive amount of respect for Robbie and what he's created. He's absolutely killed it. And the work, what a lot of people don't understand is the work he put in, or still puts in. But in those days, putting the work in on top of a job and having kids, yeah, was incredible. But some channels got to a point at which I think their quality control could have been better. And I think some of them pushed rants at the expense of the wider viewpoint. And therefore, I think you could aim criticism at them saying that they were interested in the negative, or they were, I suppose, inclined towards the negative. And I think unfairly, sometimes that's all aimed at Arsenal Fan TV. But that's just because they're the most successful. Yeah. I think if I had an issue, and again, I've made this fairly clear in the past with what they did, it was that I don't think enough people in the industry were taking the duty of care towards contributors seriously. And this isn't really talked about as much as the whole rant idea. But when you put somebody on camera, knowing that they might get millions of views, you have to take their health and their mental health into consideration.
Absolutely.
And I think as an experienced pro, I again, coming from TV, that's really well established. So I think I always knew where the boundary was. But when you come into this industry as a young or inexperienced creator, you naturally aren't schooled in some of those aspects, the more nuanced aspects of the industry than others. And I think some people have theoretically been put at risk more than they could have been, given the way that side of the industry has moved. And we look at Claude specifically. I know now he's not on the channel because something he did that was outrageous. But I think there was always an accident waiting to happen there, whether it was something he did or something someone did to him, or whether it was his own health. But I think that's the biggest criticism I'd aim at them. I think in any aspects of the industry, my opinion is have a balanced editorial view. Balance the editorial benefits and the short-term, I suppose, financial benefits of any clip that you post online, and think about the long term. And this is going off on a tangent, but
not at all.
Spen and Jack were talking about football Twitter the other day on their podcast, and what they say is relevant here. They were saying, if you're someone who trolls on football Twitter, don't use age as an excuse. Think about where you want to be in 5 years' time. Think about the person you want to be. So do you want to say that in that tweet? Do you really want to say that in that video? Do you really want to upload that video? And I think that's a good rule of thumb for any of us in any aspect of the industry. So to summarise a very long answer, yes, I think some of the criticism aimed at fan channels is valid. But I think, like any aspect of the industry, there are good and there are bad. There are good days and there are bad days. I still think there's a place for them, and I hope there'll always be a place for them. It's amazing to me when I see smaller football clubs, you know, come up with fan channels.
Hashtag have a fan channel, do they not?
Not smaller.
Well, yeah,
not in a media sense.
No,
I stuck my foot in it there.
No. Actually, I'm thinking about. No, yeah, they haven't. I'm thinking more about Oxford. I don't even know if they have a fan channel. But we certainly have fan-led podcasts. And I think it's brilliant, because remember, the genesis of that side of the industry was to give fans a voice. So it doesn't matter if you follow Oxford or Man United or Hashtag. Have an independent voice. And I think it's valuable. And I think deep down, a lot of football clubs like it. You know, it's irrelevant, really, me saying that in terms of the Hashtag fan channel, because we come at content from a completely different direction to a Man United, because we need to. But I think fan channels have a place in any football club's kind of content environment, if you like. And I would really like to have seen fan channels work more closely with clubs. And it's one disappointment and regret I think I have from my time at Fremantle, that we weren't able to build those relationships with the clubs. But I fully understand why that doesn't happen.
Yeah. You raised a really interesting point, I thought, there about how you exercise your editorial control and decided not to release some clips that would go viral, because you thought of the kind of the long term and just the health of the people who'd be on camera. I've had a lot less experience in the industry, but over the last year or so, I've been working in the kind of sports media industry, and I've seen from a personal point of view that it's a place where negativity sort of thrives. I think we saw that again closer to home with you and with the Spencer and Seb talking about their experience with the F2, who are a big brand on YouTube, talking about negativity. It does gain views, interactions, and that, and the kind of pot at the end of the rainbow in terms of online interactions. But how do you make sure you create content that is positive, that shows people in a positive light, and creates positive interactions within the community?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges of this side of the industry and the digital industry is that it's metrics driven. It's really a double-edged sword, in that the advantage of this side of the industry is that it's metrics driven, right? Because you get an immediate reaction in terms of your content. But it's also a massive disadvantage, because in the wrong case scenario, you're forced into creating content that either the algorithm demands or the audience demands. And as we know, the audience doesn't always demand positivity. So it is a challenge, especially to anybody wanting to create a commercially viable product. Because ultimately, a lot of people, you know, the way the industry works is you're driven by views. On a simple level, the more views you get, the more engagement you get, the more money you get. It's not always as simple as that. So I think it's really hard to resist that. But I don't see it as negativity driven. I think the audience wants drama and excitement and emotion.
Yeah.
Now, negativity is one of the most forceful emotions, certainly in football, that we all feel as football fans, right? We've all screamed and shouted at our team, even if we shouldn't do it. But negativity is a really primal emotion, and that's why it's easy to tap into it. But positivity is, like I said on Full Time Devils, the day Manchester United won the league, or the
it's
day
okay,
after.
You can become one of them.
No, well, do you know what? I really developed a soft spot for them, but that's because I'd spent a lot of time around fans and in the area.
Yeah.
And one of the highlights of my career was that day on the streets of Manchester, watching and filming tens of thousands of fans and the open top bus. And I had no connection really to Manchester United, but I really got sucked into that wave of euphoria. Now, that's powerful too, you know. Now, so at the moment, for example, bringing it back to hashtag, we are riding a positive wave. For me, the problem is not when you're riding a wave of positivity or negativity. It's when things are so-so, because there's no drama there.
Yeah.
You know, a 0-0 draw creates no drama. It's about the balance between positive and negative. And both those sides of the scale, both those ends of the scale are valuable, but you've just got to get the balance right. The hardest thing is being in the middle. So you've got to create emotion and you've got to create debate. But that debate doesn't always have to be a negative focused debate. You know, you and I can debate who are the greatest back four that Man United have ever had. And that would be probably an engaging piece. Well, it wouldn't, because I don't know much about them, but it could be an engaging piece of content, right?
Yeah.
That's neither positive nor negative. It's encouraging debate. So I'd say focus on drama. Focus on drama and debate. And out of that will come engagement and success.
Hmm.
If you've got a longer term view, and one of the beauties of being here is that our partners Adidas and Football Manager signed up for 3 years, so we didn't have to go searching for immediate views. We knew that our future was assured for at least 3 years, right? So we could have a longer term view on the performance of content. So we were able to build a story without knee-jerking every week. We were able to build a consistent content strategy we were able to engage and grow an audience consistently rather than relying on viral hits. And that's where I think forward-thinking rights owners, holders, or just creators should be looking at. Mm-hmm. But it's not always easy to look at the long term.
So going back a bit, we've alluded to it slightly, but I just find it interesting with you've mentioned this experience that you have in the industry. But I was wondering, our target audience is very much people looking to get into the industry. Was Soccer AM your first job in the media, or was there something before that? And if so, how did you get into Soccer AM?
So it wasn't the most traditional route. Mm-hmm. And I'd be very surprised if anybody now goes down that route. But I fanned around for a few years after university. I wanted to be an actor and director at first. And I spent a lot of time in the West End trying to pretend I was doing that, but I wasn't. And I fell into the media industry actually really accidentally. I got a job at Channel 5 when they just started mm-hmm. on the duty office. And what the duty office is every broadcaster has a requirement in there, in the Ofcom regs, I believe, to have a place of contact with the public. So it's like kind of customer service. So in the early days of Channel 5, back in, what, 97, I was on the duty office. So I was answering complaints, mainly complaints, about the output on Channel 5. And in those days, when they first started, Channel 5 was A, really hard to get hold of, and B, really terrible telly. Mm-hmm. The schedule was dominated by cheap nature programs, cheap softcore porn, and useless football games. And all of that, the environment of all of that was that X percent of the population couldn't actually receive Channel 5, and the ones who could had a terrible picture. So that was my life for about a year, answering those questions. I got into that because I had customer service experience, not because I wanted to get in the media. From there, I got a job at Sky scheduling the promos and the ad breaks before The Simpsons. And that, again, was an admin job. But as most people in the industry will tell you, and it's still the case now, once you get that foot in the door, however you get that foot in the door, then there's that chink of light, right?
Yeah.
Then you're closer. Because I don't know about now, but in those days, you could get hundreds of CVs for a job on Soccer AM, thousands perhaps. But if a guy who works in the department over the road emails you on lunchtime saying, can I come over and have a chat, then he's naturally, right or wrong, going to get an easier look in, right?
Yeah.
And that's what happened. I emailed Tim and said, look, this, you're my favourite TV show. Can I come and work for nothing? I work at Sky Monday to Friday. I'll come in on Saturday and be a runner. And bear in mind, I was 29 at this stage. I wasn't, you know, a kid. He said, look, come in, we'll have a chat. And we had a chat in the canteen. There was a job going, and that was it. It was honestly as simple as that.
Oh, wow.
So, and that is history. Because it was a case of right place, right time, but also a gutsy attitude towards trying to pin down the person in the position of power and offering my services for free. Now, it's not a very traditional way into telly, you know, duty office, scheduling promos, got lucky, but the got lucky part is still really valid. And again, right or wrong, and it's probably more wrong than right, there are still so many people wanting to get into the industry, and it's really hard to get yourself noticed. So if you're asking me for advice on anyone trying to do it now, what I would say is get off your butt and do it.
Yeah.
Prove you can do the job, which is exactly what you guys are doing, right? Prove that you can do this job. Show your prospective employer examples of you doing this job. And it doesn't matter whether something's filmed on your phone and edited on a, you know, shot with a potato and edited, you know, on your dad's laptop. It doesn't matter. What I want to see now as a prospective employer is you've tried it. And yeah, I want to see that you've got a bit of talent, but I want to see you've tried it. It don't send me a CV nowadays telling me you want to work in football content, but you've never made a football video. But 20 years ago, that wasn't possible for me, right? Because I didn't have a mobile phone that shot, you know, content. We were still editing on tape. So there was nothing really.
But anyone now can do
exactly
it.
Exactly now. And that's the beauty of our industry, right? The industry has been democratized. Spencer can create a channel with 2 million subscribers, KSI, tens of millions. Get off your butt and do it, and then show your employer that you can do it. It's a massively different world, and I'd be so excited if I was 17 now, wanting to get into this industry. Show me how much you want it. You know, I may get you in to do a week's work experience. I know there's a big debate to be had about work experience, but get your foot in the door, prove yourself, and you will have a career. And then when you've got that career, be prepared to be flexible. I guess that's my advice.
You mentioned, it won't really apply because it's a very non-traditional route into the media. But I actually think that implies more than anything else, because of the people we've spoken to, there's no one who's just gone, well, I went straight into a grad scheme, then from there I worked my way up and I was fine. Like, we've had people who are like, oh, I did translation for this because I happened to have that skill and knew I wanted to work in the industry. We've had people work in hospital radio because it just happened to be the next step that they were able to get their foot in the door. So I think you've actually said some interesting stuff about just persistence and getting your foot through the door.
Persistence and creativity, I think, in terms of how you get in the industry. And at the game the other night, a guy came up to me and said, I worked with you 10 years ago. Robbie Knox gave you my number and I was operating a boom at a shoot you did, and now I'm at Copper 90.
Oh, wow.
That's how it works. That's how it works, guys. Get yourself in, get your foot in the door, prove your talent, and you should be okay. I accept it's really hard to get yourself noticed, but I'm far more likely to notice you if you've got a link to a video you've made than if you've got a lovely looking CV.
Word you mentioned earlier, Neil, that I found was really interesting was to be gutsy.
Yeah.
And when looking at your story, I thought, you know, you've kind of been there, done that. After, correct me if I'm wrong, but after your TV work finished, you were looking for a job and decided to found your own production company. And so you had a brilliant year travelling the world, meeting David Beckham, Rio Ferdinand, Ethan Berg with Gordon Banks. And I believe you said that those who are afraid to test and fail are the ones who shouldn't be in the industry. So I just wanted to ask, how important is it to take that leap into the unknown? You know, there might not be a safety net down there, but it can lead to these massive rewards.
So your story's slightly incorrect, but it's it's fine. It's fine. I'm not gonna hammer your research. Don't worry. But I think it's still fairly relevant. I think, okay, so the point about having guts, I'm not the most gutsy person in the industry by any stretch of the imagination. And it's probably why it took me so long to get there in the first place. And I also don't have the thickest skin, given that I work in social media. But yeah, guts and determination and persistence are really important in this industry. It's a tough industry. And believe me, my days at Soccer AM, there were some really, really tough days. You know, so a lot of people fell by the wayside. And to a certain extent, there were days when that job was quite toxic, I have to say. But highest highs and lowest lows of my life, right? So I learned a lot back then. I learned I actually could do it, and I had a really thick skin. I think the industry's changed in many respects since then. But in terms of leap of faith in my career, it wasn't quite as you explain it, but it was similar. I left Soccer AM with Tim Lovejoy and four or five of the other producers. And we didn't lose our job. And sorry, Joey the Sheep has just come in. He's a terror. We didn't lose our job. We left of our own accord because we wanted to take a leap into the unknown of this new digital content world. Tim partnered with Simon Fuller, who was David Beckham and Spice Girls agent. Not agent, like a management company. And we went to 19 to essentially run a video site. It sounds so strange now because it sounds so old-fashioned, but this was before anyone had heard of YouTube. And our idea was to create, quite simple, to create professionally produced, relevant digital video content.
Right.
Whether that was music, comedy, football, or general entertainment-based. Now that just sounds like a YouTube channel, right? But in those days, there weren't YouTube channels. So that was a massive leap of faith for us, especially Tim, who was a producer and presenter on the biggest football show probably on telly. But we did it. It failed. It failed pretty fast. But that was, for me, a turning point in my career in the sense that I just had a baby. It was hard to get back into telly because I jumped from probably the best job I was ever going to have into this new digital world. But I'd come out with new skills. As a TV producer back in those days, you didn't push buttons, right? I did everything. I wrote scripts. I produced voiceovers. I did the running order. I produced the gallery. I produced edits, but I didn't shoot and I didn't physically edit. But at Channel B, which was this thing we did with Simon Fuller, I'd learnt how to self-shoot and how to edit. I'd learnt about digital marketing because we'd failed. And I could see that the digital video industry was changing. I'd even started learning HTML for some stupid reason. But I had this new set of skills to go with what I'd learned in TV, which were softer skills, but things like being able to work with talent and being able to handle pressure and working to deadlines and all those skills. So all that packaged together meant that when we all lost our job because the project got pulled, I had a lot of skills. And I also had a lot of contacts. So PR agencies were starting to use me and Robbie and Joe as kind of guys who could do everything. Guys, come along. We're doing this thing with David Beckham. Can you shoot it? And can you edit it? And Right. Can you ask him the questions? And can you post it while we're driving from A to B on a dongle on your laptop? And, can you write a script? You know, we were so multi-skilled by then that I had kind of future-proofed myself without me knowing it. So then, yeah, I did launch my company. It never really grew as a company, but it's the banner I've worked under since. And the website is so out of date, it's embarrassing, but nobody, I don't push anyone to do it. I became a one-man band. You know, I was a TV producer with 8 years experience, but I was a guy with a 5D in his backpack who could do these shoots. And then, yeah, I got sent around the world. I went to Trinidad for the FA to film David Beckham's academy as part of the, I think, England 2018 World Cup bid. I then went in an Alfayed's Chinook helicopter along with the FIFA inspection team, travelling around football grounds. So we went to Middlesbrough, Newcastle, Sunderland, and after Sunderland, I think we got in the Chinook, flew to Old Trafford, and in the Chinook, they're all the bigwigs there, and me editing the B-roll and uploading it when we got to Old Trafford. I did some amazing jobs. And that was really, to a certain extent, keeping the wolf from the door. You know, I was jobbing, and I was a jobbing producer, and I kind of knew I wasn't getting back into telly, so it was the next best thing. And that taught me a lot about, again, being flexible and also never in this industry now more so than ever, never think you know everything, never stop learning. As I said, I'm 50 next month. I'm learning something new every day. I'm now tweeting for hashtag, which to be honest, I shouldn't be doing. Some days I'm better than others. And the audience don't know. They're going to know soon with our documentary. They're going to know soon who I am. And they will know there's a 50-year-old bloke tweeting. But I think when I get it right, it doesn't matter how old I am. But I'm learning. I'm now loose teaching about Twitch. A 50-year-old bloke shouldn't know about Twitch. But my point is, you know, your career doesn't always go the way you expect it to go. And my advice, again, is to keep learning and keep future-proofing yourself.
So with that learning, how much did that then apply when you then started up Copper 90 with the experience of starting something up and it not being successful? That second try, how much did you learn from the first attempts before obviously making a very successful company in Copper 90?
Well, I learned a hell of a lot from the first one, which was Channel B. And I have to say, there's still some videos of Channel B floating around that have had hundreds of millions of views. And I'm not exaggerating here. There's a goldfish gag that I keep getting sent to me. And I'm like, yeah, I made it. it search goldfish gag. There's a little girl in a garden with a dead goldfish. I made that with Joe. It's had hundreds of millions of views. The girl's now a mum. You know, she gets it sent. And it's like, that's me. There are videos of Sheephead doing his ashes calls that have had tens of millions of views. So it wasn't a success. A lot of the content was great. I have to say that, and I wasn't the only person doing it, but we didn't know anything about digital marketing. And one of the first things I learned when I came to Copper was, and I think YouTube taught me this, I think they said content is, or modern YouTube success is about 30% content and about 70% marketing. Right? You can create amazing content, but if you don't know how that audience is going to see it, that content is likely to fail. So that's what I learned. And at Channel B, we had a lot of amazing production talent, but we didn't have an idea about digital marketing. So, you know, that's what I think I learned there. Copper, you know, to be honest, it was a no-brainer joining there. They headhunted me to come and run it and launch it. And they did that because of my football experience. I didn't have any YouTube experience, but they didn't have football experience at the time, the execs. So that's why they brought me in. It was an interesting 6 months there. I didn't particularly enjoy it, but it's been amazing to see what they've achieved. And of course, if I wasn't a copper, I wouldn't be here now, because I was Spen's manager. And 8 years later, he hired me. So that, there's another piece of advice there. Try to be nice to people in the industry. I will never say I'm the friendliest person in the industry. I'm one of the more stressed out people in the industry. And if you catch me on a bad day, you know, you'll see that. But I think I'm a hard taskmaster, but I'm a fair person to work with. And I think we've all met difficult and nasty people, not nasty, but less nice people in the industry. So my advice is be nice. You never know when it's going to help you out. And I certainly wouldn't say my career's on the down, but what I'd say is when I got the call from Spen 2.5 years ago to join him and essentially work for him, it was an honour, and it was a reminder that, you know, maybe I try to treat people fairly, and that's a good motto to live by.
Well, Spencer mentioned in the podcast with Jack, mate, that you basically run hashtag. So I'm guessing it's very different from a normal non-league operations director. So would you be able to just take us through what a normal day looks like for you at hashtag United?
Yeah, he exaggerated slightly. But I'm kind of one of the adults who runs it. And he, I don't mean that in a patronising way. Look, what they'd achieved was incredible. And as I say, I wouldn't have come, because I was having a great time at Formula E. I wouldn't have come if I didn't have a massive respect for what they'd achieved. And they were doing fine, and their views were off the scale, but it wasn't sustainable for several reasons. So I came in to mostly run the content. So I suppose I'm media and operations director, which is why my role really isn't relevant to anybody else in this side of the industry. But it's mostly content. It's also operations. So, wow, on a day-to-day level right now. Okay, so number one, I manage the media team. So at the moment, that is LP, although LP is pretty much self-sufficient because he's now working on Twitch. But until about 3 weeks ago, LP was doing most of the editing. Stampy is now our main editor. And we've got Danny, who's just come in, who's making the behind-the-scenes documentary. So they are our content team, and I'm their line manager. But I guess what that means is I'm responsible for content strategy. You know, what we put out, how we put it out, when we put it out, what we do and don't film. You know, we can't film every game, and that's increasingly an issue. We can't film every game. We can't post every game. So what are we going to focus on? What's the tone? Quality control of the edit. But at the moment, I'm running the Instagram and Twitter as well. So it's me tweeting on a match day. And if you look carefully in the BBC the other day, my daughter found me just looking stressed, looking at my phone, tweeting. Because I don't know if you've ever done one, but live tweeting penalty shootouts is not easy.
No, so, I wouldn't enjoy that.
So at the moment I'm doing that. I'm also doing a bit of design. I'm also doing a bit of editing. I do some of the shooting. That's the media side of things. Oh, I make the programme, helped with some volunteers, but I edit the programme. I deal with media requests. So I was liaising with the BBC the other night. What else? That's kind of the media side. And also now, obviously, we've got the women's team and to factor in and the youth teams. And the operations, I'm doing less of this than I was, but essentially it was things like budgeting, being responsible for that, working with Alex, although she's taken over now, on the merchandising and kit side of things. It's a family business, essentially. It can be making sure we've got mascots. I'm the one who liaises with Bowers when we have home games. So I'm usually the one who, you know, locks up. I was writing the risk assessments for COVID. So it's a very varied role, put it that way. I mean, if I tell you how big the team is, Spen's the boss, but obviously he creates his content, so he doesn't spend a lot of time here. Seb is commercial director, works from home, does all the deals, but I activate the deals. So I'm essentially the account manager for Adidas and FM as well, and Lucozade. So when we've got a shoot to do for them, I will produce those. Alex looks after the office and the merch and the finance. Then there's the media team, and that's kind of it for HQ, you know. And then we have an army of volunteers who help, you know, coaching and Stevie CB doing the you know, the physio and people on match day. It's a bigger operation, and Forest Glade will have 20 to 30 coaches there. But I basically, you know, do a lot of the operations and media at the HQ. It's quite hard to quantify, but 20 years ago, I thought I was going to be a TV producer. And now my roles, again, I just wear so many hats.
So you've mentioned about the documentary, and that's obviously what we can expect next. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit of what we can expect from that coming up, and also just what we can expect from yourself and Hashtag in the future.
So we wanted to get the documentary off the ground 2 years ago. And for one reason or another, it didn't happen. But when I came in, I was aware that we had to tell the story in a different way because the matches were so regular that they couldn't do what they used to do, which is wait 2 weeks and edit it and put it out in their own time. Everything had to be more real time. And in doing that, what we lost was an element of the narrative that I talked about, the kind of overarching narrative of the club, because it's all about match days. We tried creating other content, like training content, and we want to do more of that. But in the end, the schedule on YouTube just got so packed that we weren't telling some of the stories we should tell. You know, letting a bit more light in on what happens at the club, letting you get to know, you know, people at the club, whether it's me or Spen or Danny or, you know, Seb or the players or the manager. So we're finally committed to it. It's going to have a longer lead. And the beauty of that is we know what the storylines are going to be. So at the moment we're working on episode one, and you know, it's covering lockdown. It's covering the start of the season. And literally after this, I'm doing my interview for that. So we don't normally have that freedom to know where the drama came from, if that makes sense. So we're going to be able to tell the story in a far more relaxed way, and also to shed some light. People don't know what this HQ looks like. Well, you guys do now, because I've shown you one of the rooms, but other people don't. You know, we keep the location a secret, but, you know, it's important to show that we are not in a massive corporate office here. We are in an old medical facility. It used to be, I think, a beauty salon or a physio salon or something. There are so many stories and aspects to this club that people don't really know. And I think what's fascinating about us is there's a bit of a gap in perception versus reality. And we create that, knowingly create that. You know, people think we are, in some respects, a big club. But you're right when you say we're a small club and we're a family-run business and we're not telling those stories. You know, as I say, you've got Spencer, his dad's the physio, his mum does hospitality and is a super fan, his brother's the commercial director, his other brother's the old producer, his fiance is, you know, running finance. It's amazing. It's an amazing family business. Mm-hmm. And we want to tell all these stories. So the current plan is episode one will go out some point in October, and there'll probably be monthly episodes telling the behind the scenes story of the season. And already the drama, I know you've seen it, but some of the drama behind the scenes is incredible, you know. And I haven't even talked about esports yet. You know, we are a unique company.
Well, it's a very exciting time. And I know myself and Michael, we've been following the journey from the start. And I think we're both, I'm currently in quarantine actually, but as soon as that's over, we're both looking forward to hopefully maybe grabbing some tickets if the next FA Cup draw is a home game. but we don't want to keep you for too long. I know you've got your business, you've got your documentary to film, and your day doesn't sound like you even have time to sleep. So no, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day, and a very happy birthday for next month.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that. I'm trying to ignore my birthday next month. but what I will ask, if you come to the game next month, please keep your distance.
Yeah
not from me, but because one of the issues, and it's a long one, I know you're trying to wrap up, but one of the issues I've had to deal with this week again as part of my operations role is you know the COVID regs, and look, we take it really, really seriously, and I know that people looking at the BBC feed, aspects didn't look great, but it's really hard to tell fans to social distance. You know, it's really hard. We had stewards there. We had all the regs in place. It's really hard to enforce.
Especially for penalty shootout, sure.
It's so hard to enforce social distancing, and I'm having to look at it for the next round, but we already had one example of it, and yeah, really hard. So if you do come, please stand 2 metres apart.
Thank you so much for your time today, Neil.
No problem.
We'll let you go, but thank you for sharing your words of wisdom, and speak to you soon. Music and sound design for this podcast was provided by the brilliant Dylan Therine-Bibbs.